Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Hello and welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. I'm your host, Sarah Whitmire, hosting today with Joe Wren. Today, we are talking with our guests about the severe storm that came through South Central Indiana, Monroe County, on Tuesday. It came through with 70-mile-per-hour winds in some places. It took down a lot of power lines and caused a lot of debris. It looks like roughly 6,000 people are still without power on Duke Energy's map. That doesn't account for folks who are on UDWI. You can follow us today on Twitter or X at WFIU WTIU News. You can also email us questions at news@indianapublicmedia.org. Our phone number is 812-855-0811. Our producers assembled this panel so that you can call in if you have questions about your own circumstance and they can try to provide some help. We have a great lineup today. We have Matthew Eckhoff. He's with the National Weather Service. He's a meteorologist there. Mary Moran is with the Indiana Department of Homeland Security, and she's the Director of Emergency Management and Preparedness. We also have Captain Vinyl Lee with the Salvation Army here in Bloomington, and Doug Childs with the Utilities District of Western Indiana. He's the CEO. He'll be joining us in the second half of the program. And then in studio, we also have Aubrey Cedar, who's representing the Community and Family Resources Center with the City of Bloomington. So thank you all so much for being here. We have a lot to get to, a lot of questions we've already had coming in, but I would like to start with meteorologist Matthew Eckhoff to just explain what happened here in Monroe County on Tuesday.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Matthew.
Perfect. Hello. We had an interesting storm system come through the other day, obviously with the severe weather, the straight-line wind damage. That was primarily what the storm produced, was a very strong winds across a wide swath. The storm began in Illinois and then quickly moved into Indiana, producing strong winds and damage near Terre Haute, and that storm system then spread southeastward towards the Bloomington area, where it produced a 78-mile-per-hour wind at the airport. And then that storm actually continued further southeast, entering into Kentucky and weakening with time. And I think it was at its peak strength between Terre Haute and Bloomington. So you guys definitely bore the brunt of it.
So what's the difference between a straight line wind and tornado in terms of speeds, I suppose?
Well, not too much difference in terms of speeds. A weak tornado can have speeds anywhere from 80 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour, and you were about 80 miles an hour. Straight line winds could be up over 100 miles an hour in the strongest thunderstorms. In terms of damage, there's not too much a difference in damage between a weak tornado and very strong straight line winds. So in this case, the straight line winds were over a very large swath. So the damage was extensive and kind of mimicked a weak tornado in many locations. A tornado tends to be small and confined, where straight-line winds can be very spread out, and way more people would see such damage in these types of events.
Now, I want to switch over to Mary here with the Department of Homeland Security. Thanks for joining us. And I know the state has been handling a lot of the emergency response communications for Monroe County. Can you describe what the situation is here right now in terms of recovery and any sort of advisories still in place?
Yes, thank you. We started the recovery efforts at the state level as soon as the event started to happen, and what we are doing now is we have teams that coordinate with the folks like the Salvation Army, with the voluntary organizations active during disaster. And then we have teams from Department of Homeland Security who are deployed down there today, who are assisting the county and doing damage assessments so that we can document and get a good awareness of the level of damage, so we can look at what kind of potential avenues of recovery are going to be needed, and then which ones we will be able to access. And we are also working, we collect the, we encourage the folks that had damage to call 211 and report that damage to us, so we can get a good idea and we can reach out to those folks and make sure that as they're, as they turn and start to recover, how we can help meeting any unmet needs.
A question that we have gotten several times from many people, maybe I'll say two questions, are how was this straight line winds and not something else? There's a lot of debate between whether it was a microburst or a supercell. So maybe you can explain the difference, Matthew. But then also, I'm not sure who's best suited to answer this this other question, maybe Mary, is even if it wasn't a tornado, if it was one of these other things, why didn't tornado sirens or some sort of warning go off? So maybe the first question, Matthew, do you want to try that one?
Yeah, sure. So to repeat the question, why was the straight line winds not something else? The system that we had come through the other day was known as a bow echo or a mesoscale convective complex. Basically, it's just a big cluster of thunderstorms that organize into a line, and certain parts of that line can bow forward and kind of surge outward. And that's primarily driven by rain-cooled air. So as it rains into the atmosphere, the air cools and it becomes dense, and that falls to the ground. And the denser the air, the faster it falls, and it can produce very strong winds when it reaches the ground. As to why it wasn't a microburst, well, this was a very large area of wind, and it occurred for quite a while from, again, Terre Haute down to Bloomington. So microbursts tend to be very small in scale, and this was much larger. And we can consider it a pretty strong downburst as well. There was parts where it was stronger, and there was parts where it was weaker. But overall, the system was pretty continuous. It maintained a bowing segment through Terre Haute, through Seymour area, and then into Bloomington, and then thereafter. So supercell thunderstorms are different. They're isolated. They tend to be the whole storm tends to be rotating. This had not much rotation. It was moving in a pretty straight line, and there were some spots that had rotation, but those were temporary and brief, and the storm as a whole was not rotating, so we didn't call this a supercell. It's a classic bow echo with strong damaging winds on the leaning edge, and it was long, lasted a long time as well, so it was able to cover a lot of ground pretty quickly.
Mary, can you answer the question about sirens, or is that something Aubrey, you can? Mary, do you know about sirens and when they're activated?
I do have some knowledge on when tornadoes, when outdoor warning sirens are best practice to alert on, but I am not the person to ask or to answer in this particular case why those sirens weren't set off this time. That perhaps would be better answered by someone else other than me.
Okay. And Aubrey is saying no, she's probably not the best person to answer on the city's behalf either.
No, it's usually at the direction of your county emergency management. And so it's an answer that only belongs to them. So okay. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone.
Well, if you look at the county website for the sirens, there's two reasons listed. One is tornado warning issued, and one would be some type of civil or other emergency.
Which this was.
And so there was no tornado warning issued, so nothing was the sirens weren't activated. Although the question I have, too, we're talking about those 78-mile-per-hour winds by the Bloomington Airport. Matthew, is that something that you can rely on radar on, or is that something you're waiting on ground reports to come in on?
In this particular case, we didn't have good radar sampling of the storm because not because of its distance from the radar, but because the storm was moving at an angle relative to the radar where it can't sample the winds. So what I mean by that is the radar can only see air that's moving directly at it or away from it. If it's moving kind of off to the side or in an angle, it really can't get a handle on how fast the wind speed is. And this storm was moving about that angle that it would have very difficult time seeing it. So the way we were issuing warnings for 60 mile an hour winds upstream, I believe, and reports started coming in showing higher winds, and then we upped the warnings, I believe, thereafter. So it was partially report-based, but we knew the meteorology ahead of time, and that's why we were able to get a warning out with about 30 minutes lead time. So there was a lot of time to prepare for it to come in and be severe, and we warned for severe winds and severe hail. But the speeds, since we can't sample them, only revealed themselves once it was sampled by the weather station at the airport. Going back, we didn't issue a tornado warning because there wasn't a tornado. It was straight line wind. So we had a severe thunderstorm warning out at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Aubrey, I want to chat with you a little bit about the response here in Bloomington. So, Vinyl, you can probably add some to this as well. But we've had some folks asking if the city has something like an emergency response unit when storms like this hit.
So today I got the chance to talk to a director of public works, Adam Wason, about the city's response to the storm. And so what he said is that immediately after Tuesday's storm, it was sort of all hands on deck at the city. The teams from street, fleet, and sanitation immediately deployed, and they started working to get all of the public rights of way cleared and usable. And then all of those same teams started working in collaboration with Duke Energy to restore power lines and to get them up and running safely. He said that there was sort of a tremendous effort that was coordinated, and that was coordinated between Bloomington and Monroe County Fire and Police, the Emergency Management Agency for the county, Duke Energy, and the City of Bloomington Utilities. All of those people were immediately started to work on that problem, and we're just really grateful as the city that we were able to have that type of collaboration between all of those agencies. So I hope that answers your question in terms of who was involved in the response to the emergency.
Yeah. David was curious. Well, David says, I didn't see one police officer at any intersection, no cones with stop signs at the traffic lights that had no power. I've never lived in a city where there wasn't someone immediately on site at all major thoroughfares to direct traffic or set up cones. So wondering if that's something that's in Bloomington's plan or.
So I can't speak to what he saw, but I do know that all of the teams that I just mentioned, you know, police, fire, utilities, emergency management, they were all out immediately after the storm happened. Yeah, coordinating to making sure that those rights of ways were cleared and that things were usable.
Can you, Vinyl, then just jump in here and explain how the Salvation Army is working with the city and the county on recovery and helping folks now?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Salvation Army responded pretty shortly thereafter the storm made its initial impact on Tuesday. And then really kind of worked on Wednesday to be kind of a coordinating source for community resources. And so our main function in this response has been kind of twofold. We've worked as kind of our position in the COAD as Community Organizations Active in Disaster to host kind of a coordinating hub, but then also provided resource in the terms of an emergency shelter that needed to be established for residents who were unable to go back to their home because of loss of power, but needing perhaps connected to power to run medical equipment or other necessary devices of that nature. And so we established a shelter there pretty quickly, and that officially demobilized this morning when we were finally able to get our last guest back into their house. But for us as the Salvation Army, we really worked as a coordinating hub to make sure that the resources that were available, resources that maybe perhaps were offline because they were without power, that all of that could be communicated effectively across partners and then to the community.
Okay. Today we're talking about storm damage and the response on Noon Edition. You can email your questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org. You can also call in and ask your question on air. 812-855-0811 is the number to call. So we got a couple questions just about charging cell phones and computers, those sorts of things. So is that something folks can come to the Salvation Army? It seems from what we've been told that there is rather a large rush at the library to go in to try to charge things.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not been a resource that we've been or something that's been asked of us before. But I mean, if there's an open electrical outlet at the Salvation Army, you're welcome to plug into it. I mean, we were with power the whole time. We experienced maybe just a momentary loss of power there on Tuesday as the storm came through, but we'd been operational the whole time. So we've had several people come in and utilize our outlets inside. They've used outlets outside to charge those things. So certainly when we're open 10 to 5, we would encourage you to come to our main office rather than our thrift store to charge those things. You're welcome to come inside, get out of the heat, charge a device. Okay. Yeah, that would be...
So your shelter is closed, but the city is still operating the cooling stations.
Yeah, those are two entirely separate resources.
And like you just said, the cooling station, so that's a joint effort, and it was arranged, I think, by Justin Baker, who is on the Emergency Management Agency team, and those are at a number of fire stations throughout the city and the county, and that full list is accessible through Emergency Management Agency's Facebook page, I think also through their website. Those cooling stations are not only a place that you can go to cool down and get cool during, you know, the heat waves that come up, but also I know that they are allowing people to plug in, like you said, to charge their devices. Also really important for people who rely on medical devices that have backup batteries, but many of those batteries, you know, might be losing charge and they need to plug in. Those are also places that are available for those folks to go and charge those devices.
Yeah. Great. And those cooling stations are available even outside of these disaster moments. So anytime it meets that certain weather threshold, right, when it's going to have these extreme heat temperatures, those cooling stations are going to be available. And so that's an ongoing resource that the city and the county provide to residents.
Okay. Matthew, I know we only have you for the first half of the program here, so I want to try to get to a couple of these other listener questions before you have to go. I'm sorry, I lost my place here. But we had someone wonder if you could talk about what areas were not affected within the city. Some neighborhoods, it seems, were not. And if you could explain why it happened that way.
Yeah, of course. It looks like the primary area of winds went through what the radar and the reports here show. It looks like it went through the south part of town the most. All of the city was affected. We have reports coming in from the east side, trees and limbs down. And we have trees and limbs down on Moore's Pike, for instance. And then on the west side, we have a report that has trees and limbs down. And, of course, the 78-mile-per-hour wind at the airport. I would say the farther north you went through the city and then even outside of the city, the less wind you saw. The angle that the storm was coming in at was coming in from the northwest and was diving southeast, and it didn't hit the city square on. It kind of came more focused on the central and south side. So I would say the northern parts of the area were the least affected, but everywhere it seems was affected to some extent.
Okay. And then I think, Mary, maybe you would be best suited to answer this. Karen wants to know, when dangerous weather is approaching, how do we prepare with staffing with emergency response teams like ER staffing and first responders?
Well, part of the things that we work with the local communities on is training opportunities to get them to communicate and coordinate during a response. Teach them how the state integrates and acts as their assistance when their resources runs out. We help provide a lot of preparedness information for different kind of risks that exist in Indiana. So those are just some of the actions that we take.
Matthew, I'm going to jump in one more question here before you have to leave. How can the people, I've been seeing so many questions on social media too about just about the sirens not going off, and now we understand why. But how can the county be maybe better prepared next time or get information about these 78 mile per hour winds to be able to warn people?
Sure. Yeah. Well, obviously have a way to get warnings. We have our website, weather radios, they go off immediately when a warning is issued, any warning. Our warnings have impact-based tags as well, so we can issue a base warning for like 60 miles per hour, considerable warning for 70 miles per hour, and then a destructive tag for anything over 80 miles per hour. And those warnings, depending on their severity, will either not or they will trigger the wireless emergency alert system, a.k.a. your phone will go off if the warning is issued. We also have for EMs and various county and state level partners like that, we have our Slack channel and Weather Service NWS chat, and you can communicate with us there. We'll give updates on the storm as it happens. You could read our forecast discussions on our website and or just look for the warnings on any kind of media as they come out live. And especially again, the weather radio is probably the quickest, most efficient way. But for the state level partners, they can contact us directly on the our NWS chat, and we can give them more specific help as to what's coming their way.
And Matthew, if we can ask you one more before you have to go, had a couple people say there was a prolonged outage this time last year caused by a severe storm. Is this an annual thing that we can just begin to expect and predict will happen?
We can't really extrapolate based on that. Long-term trend is a bit unclear at the moment, but there was a storm last year. That was the June derecho, if I recall correctly. That had a pretty strong wind as well, up to 80 to 100 miles an hour west of the border in Illinois, and a little bit less as it came into Indiana. These storms are not terribly uncommon area-wide, but for any one specific location, it is rather uncommon. You know, you're not going to see 80-mile-an-hour winds every single summer in Bloomington, for instance. But at least somewhere in Indiana at some point has strong winds like this, at least once or even twice a year. So this is not terribly uncommon. Again, to reiterate that, and facing long-term trends, it's hard to say at the moment. So, just always be prepared for severe weather is the best advice I can give on whether or not this is going to become a recurring thing.
Okay.
I would, it's hard to say based on the data we have.
Thank you, Matthew, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome, of course. I'm glad to be here. Thanks. Thank you.
I want to introduce Doug Childs now. Doug Childs is the CEO of the Utilities District of Western Indiana, which provides electricity for part of Monroe County. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Doing great. The last I looked, it was what, maybe about 2,000, give or take, without power?
Thankfully, we're down to about 1,300 now, so we continue to make some steady progress, albeit slow.
Tell us about what it's been like for your crews.
Oh, they've been, I couldn't be more proud of my crews. They've been working in very trying circumstances, you can imagine, working 16, 18 hour days virtually since the storm hit on Tuesday. And you can imagine the damage is so widespread. trees down everywhere. So often we have to have tree crews go in to do cutting even before our linemen can get down to even start thinking about repairs.
So we've gotten a lot of questions about how you prioritize when people get their power back. Folks saying, my neighbor across the street has power. This doesn't make sense.
No, and we can certainly understand that. We try to balance a number of things, Sarah, but primarily we try to get the most people on as quickly as we can, as you can imagine. Oftentimes when may see your neighbor have power and you're not, there might be a very localized problem still in your area, or you may be in another circuit. There may be a transformer issue. There could be a number of reasons why you may not have power.
Okay. And so it says you've had, more than about 230 damage reports and lots of broken poles. What's the process like in locating and fixing those?
Well, what we try to do is, and we've got a SCADA system, and it starts really with our system showing where an outage occurred. And often we have some great members who call in and tell us where they may have seen a pole broken or a tree down. So we try to get as much information as we can out front. And then what we have to do is dispatch our crews and try to assess the situation on the ground and see what repairs need to be done.
Great. I'll say also, it looks like on the map that Duke Energy still has about 5,000 without power here in Monroe County.
Yeah, our colleagues at Duke are in the same situation.
Yeah.
So when an event like this happens, Doug, of course you said you have crews, but how much do you rely on outside help to come in and competing with that independent help?
Oh, we absolutely are very dependent, are very proactive in trying to get as much outside help as we can. Right now, we've got in five other co-ops across the state who came in to help us, as well as multiple contractors. In fact, I think right now on our system, we have about 30 units out doing repairs.
Mary, I want to ask you, Monroe County Commissioners declared a disaster here. What does that mean in terms of the circumstances and the recovery or advisories?
What that means is that they have run out of resources, basically, and need assistance. So we step in with whatever level of recovery that we can, depending on the amount of damage that we find. So that's why we have the moment that the event started, our Emergency Operations Center started gathering data on damage reports, and we're watching the reports going to the National Weather Service so we can target where we think the damage is. And then we work with the local official, the emergency management agency, and we bring in state teams that are now going to help them literally go street by street and look at what occurred in this event. And then we can gauge what potential resources we might be able to bring to the table.
Okay. And Vino, you've been involved in that you were involved in last year's recovery,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
can you talk a little bit about how this compares and what we can expect over the next few days?
Yeah, I mean, every disaster is different, though it has flavors that are similar, certainly. I think we can expect that. So for the incident that occurred in March in Steinsville, for that tornado that came through, that was a much longer recovery process. Right. And there we saw, and we're still waiting on damage assessments to come back, but in a lot of these preliminary reports from 211, as well as damage assessments done by the Red Cross yesterday, we're seeing that while there's a lot of trees down, and some homes have certainly been impacted by these trees falling, the extent of damage is not nearly to the scale as what it was, say, in Steinsville when that tornado came through on Wolf Creek Road. And so what we'll see is that the recovery portion of this will look quite a bit different, where we're not necessarily, for most of our cases, going to be needing to coordinate with contractors to help coordinate the repairs of homes. Really what we're looking at is the impact of all of this food that has gone bad in people's refrigerators and freezers. For many of our families, they had either just went out and went grocery shopping and refilled that refrigerator, and now they're looking to have to replace that. And for those who are living on a fixed income and living paycheck to paycheck, that's an enormous lift for them to have to do. And so our recovery in this portion is going to be coordinating with organizations like Hoosier Hills Food Bank and other local resources to make sure that that perishable food that did indeed perish can be recouped. So whether that's through direct financial assistance, whether that's through in-kind donations of physically providing what was lost back to residents, that's really what this is going to look like for a lot of our residents compared to a lot of construction projects.
Okay.
So with that, it means that our response and recovery time frame is going to be a lot shorter because where we get to the finish line of this is a lot closer than perhaps the major damage that we see in some of these storms, like the tornado that came through the northern part of the county in March.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because we have gotten a lot of questions about where people can go for food assistance, especially some folks saying it's the end of the month. It's still a few days before I get paid. What can I do? So where can people go to get help with food, and do they have to prove anything in order to get assistance?
So there are going to be a number of different places that people can go. This is where the city is going to be such a valuable resource, and the work that that you all are doing to coordinate those resources. But I mean, even today in the midst of this conversation, for people who are listening, Hoosier Hills Food Bank has a distribution site set up there at their location that people can access. We'll see that. Your local food pantries are many of them are still operational, and we'll have resources to provide there. But then, as well as coordinating and contacting the American Red Cross, that if they haven't been by, and you need to establish a case number with them to get a hold of them, and then to also reach out to us at the Salvation Army directly, and we can begin the process of some disaster financial assistance as well. So it's just going to be connecting with your local resources, and they will and should have some additional resources available for those residents. So I would encourage contact the city and coordinate through that way. And then you can also then additionally reach out to some of those major community partners like the Red Cross, like the Salvation Army, Hoosier Hills Food Bank, who are really instrumental in these recovery processes to get people their food back.
So who do you contact at the city?
I'm glad you guys asked. So when you introduced me at the beginning, I'm Aubrey, and I am a representative of the Community and Family Resources Department at the city. And one of our major missions is to help people navigate resources locally. And so we have submitted to the Office of the Mayor and our communications team there a whole list of different resources. And a lot of those come from our meetings with the community organizations active in disaster, of which Vinyl, is a leader there. It's a document, obviously, after these things happen. Many of our community partners, and now I'm talking about, basic service organizations, they also lost power and they also lost capacity. And so it's sort of an ongoing updating people on their capacity and on their capacity to give these services that normally people can depend on is an ongoing thing, right? And so we try to do that through CFRD, through our Facebook page. But I know that the Office of the Mayor is also putting the list that we have sent them up on their website. So if you go to the City of Bloomington website, which is bloomington.in.gov, you can find on that website a list of the post-storm local resources, and that includes the cooling station, it includes bottled water distribution, it includes a lot of basically what is happening now in terms of the capacity of food and shelter organizations to help people. So I want to say, just to follow up on what Vinyl said earlier, that the Hoosier Hills, their emergency food distribution is happening today between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., like Vinyl said, at their location on West Industrial Park Drive. And they have an assortment of perishable and non-perishable goods that are available to folks. And it's a limit of 2 households per vehicle. And unfortunately, they can't deliver, which I know lots of great organizations locally have delivery programs, but those are have less capacity in some cases. In terms of places where people can get a hot meal, the Community Kitchen of Monroe County didn't lose power, so they have been operating as normal. Shalom Center's Phil's Kitchen is operating. Mother Hubbard's Cupboard got their power restored. And then Pantry 279 in Ellisville, their power is back on, and their next pantry day is going to be Saturday. So those are some local resources. And if you need the specific, like if you're using a track phone or you don't have a lot of, you know, access to internet, if you can get somewhere with the internet, you can find all of those resources. They're all centrally located in our Helping Bloomington Monroe database. It's the city's online basic resources, free and low cost resources database, and it's searchable by zip code. So all you have to do is put your zip code in and you can find a lot of those resources. So if you're able to get to a cooling station, if you're able to get to the library, all of those resources are available to you to find the specifics.
Okay. If you, yeah. What's the difference between calling one of those help numbers and then 211? What do they provide that's different?
Nothing.
Nothing.
So 211. Mary, maybe you can help.
Yeah. No, I mean that's the truth, right?
I was just.
Go ahead, Mary.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say exactly what we at Department of Homeland Security do is we try basically what we're trying to do is just be a conduit for the, for lack of a better term, a force multiplier for the locals. Hmm. So we monitor the 211 reports that come in. We publish public information about it. We get it out in all different kinds of media. And then what we do is we basically collect the information that folks call into 211, and then we review those every single day for any reports of damage or unmet needs or, you know, housing issues. And then what we do is we gather that and we provide it to the locals. So basically what 211 is just another way for folks to report. I know somebody mentioned, you know, if you don't have a high-tech cell phone and you're not very internet savvy, calling 211 is, you know, just another resource. And we're all collecting the same information and we're all coordinating with each other.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, 211, I think it's, its big difference is that it's easy to remember, right? Like it may not be easy to remember the city's website. What was that organization that they mentioned on the radio? Like, I think that's the difference for 211 is that it's an easy number to remember. So they have been excellent in reaching out and trying to coordinate some of these disaster resources as well, or at least correlate some of these disaster resources as well. And so 211 is just it's an easy way for us to remember. In disasters and outside of disasters, if you've got a resource need, 211 is an excellent community resource to try to access those.
You mentioned money for food, and we have gotten a couple questions about how to get reimbursed or get some money for food that you've lost. Is that something that needs to go through people's insurance, or can folks reach out to you?
Typically, we would encourage people to always contact their insurance. Now, reimbursements it's a whole different animal, right? And so typically what we would do is the Salvation Army, and so I can really only speak to our processes on that, is that we wouldn't do a reimbursement. What we would do is we would issue you cash assistance in the form of a check or a gift card to, say, Walmart, to go and purchase those items. And so what that allows for us is to put systems in place that we need to track where money goes. It allows us to put some safety nets inside to make sure that the money being used is being used for its intended purpose. It's easier for us in a systems and process side for us just to avoid reimbursements. And my experience is that is the case with other organizations as well. Your insurance obviously is a different animal. But for us, if those needing financial assistance, the best way to do that is to reach out to us first so that we can to get that going and get you that resource that you need.
Okay, great. Doug, a question we have gotten from so many people, and I'm sure you hear it all the time, is wouldn't it be better if our utilities were underground?
It would be wonderful if there was a more widespread underground system than every utility has. The trouble is not only the cost, but the terrain, particularly over around the Bloomington area, with all the natural stone, it's pretty difficult to underground, but the cost would simply be absolutely prohibitive, particularly for a rural utility like UDWI, which in some parts of our system may only have 3 or 4 members in an entire mile. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of cost and geography.
Another question is one of the factors you consider in putting lines underground whether they are more prone to weather-prone power outages?
Yes, that's absolutely one factor, as well as maintenance costs. We always look at reliability as the number one goal.
Okay.
I have a quick question too. How do you come up with power restoration estimates for getting your power back?
It's very difficult to do.
And, I bet.
That's one of the things, particularly in this storm, you have to go out and as you can imagine, first thing you have to do is assess what's out there. And in many cases, if poles are broken in particular, you have to perhaps return back to our headquarters to get the material to do the repairs. But it's generally after you assess the situation, you can see what's there. Then you have to look at your manpower and you try to combine all those and come up with an estimate. And you can imagine when you've got an event this widespread, it's nearly impossible to have estimates that are worth anything.
We got just a comment that says there's an infrastructure problem and it keeps trying to be fixed with Band-Aids. Maybe you can just speak to that just in terms of the cost of big repairs and big improvements.
Sure. To give you an example, I've been at UDWI around 6 years. And since I've been here, the cost of building a mile of three-phase line has gone up about 60%, to give you some idea. The cost to do infrastructure improvements on the electrical side are enormous, not to mention difficulties in getting right-of-ways, getting construction, getting personnel. Obviously, you've got supply chain issues as well. So there are a lot of challenges on the infrastructure side.
Okay. I think just picking up on the food that we've been talking about, what do folks do with their spoiled food?
Throw it away.
So there was this thing online that apparently several folks have read. Maybe you all have. I don't know if it ended up on Reddit or what. That said, the landfills are full. They're not going to pick up your spoiled food.
So one thing about the spoiled food that I can say first is that we got some information because people were asking about their SNAP benefits and replacing
yes.
those SNAP benefits. Like you said, you know, the end of the month is coming. And so before you throw out your spoiled food, take a picture of that food so that you can put it in your application if you are getting SNAP benefits, right? Because that's going to show them, here is what I lost, right? I know if you still are without power, you might have to shine a flashlight on it to be able to see what's in the refrigerator. But please, take a pic photos of that food. And then another thing that I have seen online, again, with these things attached to the SNAP benefits is to have ready sort of when your power outage happened. And I think under Duke Energy, there is a way that you can go into your account if you're able and get that information. But again, if you're not able to call 211 or call the Monroe County Division of Family Resources. And again, if you're not going through 211, if you have internet and you're able to go online and find their website, find their phone number, it's also going to be on the city website for easy. access, but the Monroe County Division of Family Resources, they're out on Curry Pike, and they're a great staff, and they are going to be helping people with any of your FSSA benefits, but specifically with those SNAP benefits and restoring some of the ones that you lost because you lost that food.
I'm going to throw this question out there. I'm honestly not sure who among you would be the best to answer. Maybe Mary. But Karen says a tree fell on her truck from the neighbor's tree. So how does one go about getting help for something like that?
I am going to say that may be an insurance discussion. Tied to the owner of the property from which the tree fell. But again, I am not an insurance expert,
yes.
So I would definitely have that conversation. But as far as helping that individual, if that individual does need help with debris removal, or if they don't have insurance and can't get a repair done, I would definitely encourage those folks to call 211. And then, again, all of the resources that these folks are mentioning and all the agencies involved in the recovery now, we will try and coordinate together to find a resource to help them with that.
That's a great segue to a question we got from Amanda that says, are there emergency management agencies available to help, or like folks from Duke or UDWI that can help people with trees?
Go ahead, Mary.
No, you go ahead. I can wait.
So in terms of the debris clearing, I know when I again spoke to Public Works Director Adam Wason that as early as this weekend, the city is planning to announce a program that will help private residences clear storm debris. And this is specifically the tree debris that you're talking about. So that's going to roll out. So again, check watch the city website if you can, or listen out for that announcement. They're working with private contractors to do a couple of rounds of that debris removal. If you, like this poor woman who wrote in about the tree falling on her truck, if you are not sure whether the tree, since we have many neighborhoods in the city that have, city trees, and you're wondering, is this the city's tree? Is this my private tree? There's actually an app called Tree Keeper that our specific arborist at Parks and Rec logs the city trees in. And so if you're within city limits and you're wondering about the tree, is it the city's responsibility to come and deal with this tree that has fallen, you can use Tree Keeper. And then again, look out for that debris clearing program. The city will come and help you clear that vegetation.
Just because we have gotten so many questions about cleanup and debris. So you're saying not even having to put it out to the curb, but if you just need help cutting something up,
I'm not sure about that point. What I'm saying is that they're going to announce a program, and when they announce that program, they'll have more details for those private residence owners about it. What I know right now is that they're only going to be helping people with the vegetation removal. So the difference there is if there has been damage to your home or your property, like domestic damage, they can't pick up that stuff. It's going to only be the vegetation.
Go ahead.
And I can say that in part of that conversation, they are talking with a tree removal contractor. Now, what that means, what that ends with at the end of the day, we can maybe have some conjecture on that. But there's not been anything definite determined. We do also know that other state co-ad partners, the Southern Baptist Convention in particular, have indicated that they intend to send perhaps some chainsaw crews down as well to help with some of this debris removal. So while there's maybe not anything firmly established at this point today, we do hope that there's some more information by the end of today as to what that looks like. And so, again, we're going to point you back to 211 as a great resource to follow up with, city site, call the Salvation Army. I also want to circle back to the lady and her truck. That it is going to be complex with insurance and who owns the tree and who's responsible for it, and then how does the truck get repaired. We at the Salvation Army don't necessarily have any specific funds, but we have a really great partner that can help with vehicle repairs. And so we would encourage you to reach out to us. I'm going to gatekeep the resource just for a little bit so that we don't overwhelm them until they're fully ready to go public. But we would love to be able to connect you with that. So if you've got a vehicle concern as a result of this, reach out to us, and we'd love to connect you with that partner.
Great. A lot of good information there. Thank you. A question for Judith just about the yard waste. I just want to try to get as many answers to these as we can. But she's saying, will the city be picking up tree debris separately, or will it be with the regular yard waste pickup days? And does it need to be broken down into small pieces like it normally does?
Again, so I would say this weekend is when we're planning to announce that program.
So okay, we're just not sure on the details.
We're not sure. I know that there was a press release that came out from the Emergency Management Agency, and that was on the 27th. And so sort of reading from there that, you know, property owners with storm-damaged trees and debris are asked to cut the debris into manageable pieces and stack it near the edge of their property. So that seems to be from the EMA is saying, if you need something to do to make sure that you're ready for that pickup and you want to take action, like, that's what you should be doing. And I don't know, finally, if you have any more information.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the same thought, which seems to indicate that it doesn't have to be as cut up as perhaps we're historically used to. We are encouraging curbside, keep it clear of the roadway, but to get it as close to the curb as possible without impeding the roadway would be the best way to get that debris removed from your property.
Okay. We have less than a minute left. Mary, I want to give you the final word here to just those folks who are listening and maybe still don't have power or dealing with a lot of damage. What can you tell them to do next and what to do over the next few days?
The most important thing is reaching out and making sure that someone knows about the damage and the impacts that they sustained. And then again, just to start documenting if they do have damage or they did lose food and that sort of thing. And the other thing to be aware that as there will be teams from the state out over the next few days collecting damage information. So again, just make sure that they're reporting their damage or any unmet needs that they might have as well.
Great. Thank you so much for that. I want to thank our guests for being here today. We've covered a lot, and hopefully this has been helpful to our audience. Matthew Eckhoff, meteorologist with the National Weather Service, Mary Moran, Captain Vinyl Lee, Doug Childs, Aubrey Cedar. It's been fantastic having you, and thank you so much for all the information. That is all the time we have. Also, thanks to our producer, Benta Boothier and Kathy Knapp, engineer Mike Pashkash, co-host Joe Wren. I'm Sarah Whitmire. Thanks for listening.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Support for WFIU comes from our sustainers and from IU Summer Theater presenting Dial M for Murder, a fresh take on the classic Hitchcock film. Same greed, same sinister plot, but with a few new twists. Running July 6th through the 27th. More at theater.indiana.edu.